Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Zach DePhillip and Dr. Andrew Bruner of Massachusetts General Hospital, both members of the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy, or ASTCT, Committee on Practice Guidelines. Together, we examine the new guidelines published for transplant in the management and treatment of MDS. We discuss their findings on the most current indications for transplant, addressing changes in risk stratification and the success of transplant in older patients. To read bios on the session moderator and panelists, and to access additional resources related to this panel discussion, click the link in the episode description. This is part one of a two-part episode. All right. So I am here with Dr. Zach DePhillip and Dr. Andrew Bruner. It's a pleasure to meet you both, and thank you both for joining me today on Explore Cell Therapy.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Sam.
Of course. So today we're discussing the current evidence and recommendations for the use of allogeneic transplant in the management and treatment of myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, which is a rapidly evolving field with a lot of recent potentially practice-changing research. So as transplant and hematology oncology physicians, I understand that you both worked closely on a committee of physicians with the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy, ASTCT, to publish an evidence-based review. Can you tell me a little bit about how that got started and what your major goals were for that project?
Sure. So I am a transplant physician, and I have been involved with ASTCT for a number of years, and I currently serve as a member of the Practice Guidelines Committee. And the Guidelines Committee is tasked with a number of important initiatives, and one of those initiatives is helping, you know, evaluate the data that comes out and try to come to some consensus for the transplant field and for the greater oncology field of, you know, how do we apply transplant for different specific conditions? And in those areas, you know, where is maybe the data stronger and we can come to some consensus on how we should approach patients clinically? And then also where the areas of controversy or kind of unknowns remain. What I had noticed was that the last time that there was an official statement from the ASTCT guidelines on MDS was all the way back in 2009. The initial goal had been to update the guidelines approximately every 5 years to keep them current. But, you know, with a lot of other tasks and initiatives that maybe were a little bit higher up on the priority list, you know, some things just had kind of fallen behind, but it was definitely time to do this because there's just been so much that has gone on. Things that we take for granted in our day-to-day practice have not really been more formally addressed yet by the committee. So about a year ago, I came to the leadership committee for the practice guidelines and said, this is something that I think we need to do and something that I'd be interested in trying to help coordinate and lead. And in that, we put together a really nice team of experts. And these were experts that were both transplant physicians, but we also wanted to include physicians who were maybe not primarily transplant experts, but maybe more disease or specific MDS experts. And when we did that, Dr. Bruner was definitely one of the physicians that we wanted to bring on to the project.
Yeah, and I can give a little background about myself as well. My work is primarily in developing novel therapeutics in MDS. It's an area of need that has now spanned several decades, unfortunately. With a few advances happening in the last couple of years, primarily in lower risk disease. And so we are constantly trying to use what we learn about the disease, basic science, you know, the underlying pathophysiology of it, or better understanding of, you know, the natural courses of disease, and to refine our treatment strategies based on that. And so when the opportunity arose to try to use some of what we've learned about MDS in general, and about how it behaves, who's going to live a long time with it, whose courses might be shorter before they run into challenges from the disease, you know, I thought this was a great opportunity to collaborate and talk about one of the core therapies that is still underutilized in MDS therapy of transplant.
No, absolutely. And it sounds like it had been a while since ASTCT had put out these recommendations, so it was really needed. I'm curious, what are, you know, to give some context, what are some of those major challenges in the management of MDS that make this review right now so important?
I mean, from my perspective, MDS is so heterogeneous. And when you meet a patient with MDS, all of them have kind of a different course to coming to presentation in the clinic. They also all have different limitations in their life, different problems. Some patients will have very obvious symptomatic disease, right? So people with severe anemia, their lives are impacted by their disease. They're not doing the things that they used to want to do. They might have bleeding issues or recurrent infections, and their quality of life is not where they want it to be. And so discussing interventions to try to fix that with them is one type of conversation. But I also have patients whose disease has a lot of high-risk features, but they feel fine. They came to attention because of incidental low blood counts. And we can see the writing on the wall. We see the challenges that lie ahead. But at the moment, they're doing okay. And it's a very different conversation to talk to them about going through treatment that's really disruptive for a period in order to fix their bone marrow so that they have years ahead. And I think that part of the challenge, certainly in managing MDS, is that it is so patient specific. You know, you want to make sure that you're giving them the right advice about this is the course we need to take.
Yeah. You know, along the lines of what Andy's talking about here, you know, there are different tools that we have clinically to try to help kind of tease out disease risk. And these are things that have evolved over time. So, you know, people who are listening may be familiar with the IPSS or the International Prognostic Scoring System. And this is, you know, was initially developed looking at a few key measures of MDS disease that may help stratify patients to say, hey, this is a patient whose disease is maybe a little more high risk. This patient's a little more, you know, maybe some of those factors are absent. Their disease is categorized as lower risk, you know, but this has evolved. So there's the IPSS, and then it was revised to kind of add more information as data emerged. And so there's the IPSSR. And more recently, there's a lot of data that's emerging about specific mutations that can occur during the disease. And there's been a very recent publication with the IPSS-M that includes these molecular the molecular data in trying to understand who's at higher risk in terms of their disease course. And when I went back and I looked at where the guidelines currently were, and when we last published these guidelines, you know, we were still only had IPSS. We didn't even have IPSSR, forget IPSSM. So it just feels like, I think one of the huge things that, as Dr. Bruner brought up, is like just trying to figure out who would be most likely to benefit from transplant, and what's the ideal timing of that transplant. You know, who may be able to kind of go on for a longer period of time before eventually needing transplant? Who should you maybe kind of say, no, you know what, earlier is maybe going to be better. And also keeping in mind that even outside of that, you know, that's really focused on the disease and the patient, but transplant practices have evolved and transplant outcome, you know, there's more donor options and donor availability. There's, you know, better anti-infection medications, better way to prevent complications with the transplant. So, you know, we're also dealing with a situation where transplant now in 2023 is not what transplant was in 2009.
Yeah, I think, you know, our understanding of disease has evolved so much. And when you're recommending a therapy, you're thinking not just about the toxicity of that therapy, you're also thinking about the potential benefit. And to Zach's point, you know, we have such a better understanding of what patients are likely to live a long time with their MDS. And, you know, maybe intervening early is not really needed for all of those patients. For many of these patients, right, they'll be diagnosed and there may be some time before they even require an intervention. But what our molecular understanding of disease has really done is just refined who's actually at risk of having complications within the next year or two. And these patients have a much higher burden of disease. They have a shorter overall survival. One of the biggest things we've realized when we incorporate mutations into the risk scoring of disease is that many people are upscaled in their risk. So people that we thought would just live a long time with MDS and maybe they would have progressive anemia, we're finding that actually we were underestimating the risk of their disease and its threat to their livelihood and lifespan. And I think that as transplant has also moved into, you know, transplant practices have become more available to patients who might have previously been less likely to be considered because of age or because of other somewhat arbitrary factors. You know, it's important that we shift our understanding to A, recognize who can benefit from this, and B, you know, that we need to be optimizing therapy on an individual level for each patient that we see.
Now, that's really interesting, especially to hear that between those iterations of the risk stratification from IPSS to IPSS-R to IPSS-M, you're seeing this shift to higher risk classifications than you would otherwise have anticipated earlier. I'm really curious to dig a little bit deeper into some of those key advances that you were alluding to in both the transplant space and overall MDS treatment and management that have led to these current consensus recommendations that you put forward in the publication. Were there any findings or recommendations that you think are especially critical to call attention to, or that you think listeners might find surprising based on how things have evolved?
I'm not so sure about necessarily surprising, but I think one of the things that we cover in these guidelines is the issue of referral to transplant for patients with more advanced MDS. And I think that in the last year or so, there have been some very important large studies that have maybe kind of solidified what our previous thought was that maybe we didn't have as good of evidence for. So, you know, the fact that a transplant is a potentially curative approach for MDS is something that's been established and known for a very, very long time. But I think one of the biggest questions that remained was like, what's the optimal application of transplant in the MDS disease treatment? Knowing that kind of there is this spectrum of disease in MDS, and you can have patients who are on the lower risk side, you can have patients that are a higher risk side, and it's kind of intuitive that how you treat patients on the ends of these spectrums are probably not the same. Until recently, we really relied on a few important studies that were done using large retrospective data sets. and analyses were kind of done that were trying to look at, hey, you know, if transplants, you know, applied earlier, is that good, or should it be delayed and maybe wait till a little bit later? And what those studies essentially showed was that if you had more advanced MDS, so higher risk features, implementing and undergoing transplant earlier on in your treatment course was probably going to be beneficial, where if you had lower risk disease, you could probably hold off and maybe only use transplant at a time when the disease started to kind of behave in a more high risk manner. What we now have are two prospective trials. One was conducted in Europe, one was conducted here in the United States, that looked at kind of the progression of patients with higher risk disease and what happens if they're able to go under a transplant or they don't go under transplant. Now, these weren't necessarily your classical randomized trials, but essentially, you know, older patients with MDS that had higher risk features, so the population that we really have the question about transplant for, they underwent HLA typing, right, which is your tissue typing in order to see if you have a suitable donor for transplant, a full match donor, with the caveat being for these studies. And if the patient had a full match donor, the ultimate plan was that that patient would go to transplant. If they did not have a full match donor, the ultimate plan was that that patient would continue with non-transplant therapies. One study, as I said, in Europe was called the Videza-Allo study, where patients initially were treated, all patients were treated with hypomethylating agents, specifically with azacitidine, and then either to transplant or continued azacitidine. In the study that was conducted in the United States, the BMT-CTN-1102 study, that trial did not specifically mandate the use of HMA-based therapy. Both studies showed an improvement in disease-free and overall survival for the patients who were in the donor arms or the patients who were undergoing transplant. So it really, I mean, that data really solidifies, and these were not limited to younger patients. In one study, I believe the age range was 50 to 55 to 70. The other one was, I think, 50 to 75. So this was, I think, very representative of the types of patients that myself and Andy take care of together in clinic. And I think that this is really important to know, you know, for the community, for patients, for oncologists that maybe don't see as many MDS patients, is that for patients with traditional high-risk features, getting these patients in to see a transplant physician and be evaluated for transplant is immensely important.
Yeah, I think you know, how have I shifted my practice? I think that the biggest takeaway for me for some of these studies, yes, they validated the practice. When you have high-risk features, it's important to undergo transplant. You know, when we approached MDS compared to acute leukemias, the transplant initiation, the discussion about transplant, historically could be a little more of an evolved, slower discussion, because I think you're still learning about that patient. Many of them were older. Some of them it'd be very clear that transplant was a goal of theirs, but for others, you're often trying to form a relationship and determine kind of what do they want out of their care and what goals do they have. The biggest takeaway for me from these studies is that people, it confirmed the value of transplant, but B, going to transplant early with high-risk MDS really matters. I think that referring patients early, at least to discuss it, getting that topic started early, that is different than what may have been a practice for many, where you might initiate therapy, explore desires, and move to a transplant later on. You know, now I'm really incorporating it into my upfront evaluation of a patient and trying to open that door, at least to exploration, with anyone who may be potentially a transplant candidate, because it does, these studies do seem to support as good as you can from such data, the idea that we should be thinking about it as an early treatment modality for MDS when patients have higher risk features. I think the other major change over the last decade, in kind of along the lines of these therapies as well, is just we've had this rapid expansion of our ability to sequence and understand the molecular composition of MDS and other myeloid diseases. It's changed the language of how we talk about blood cancers. You know, one of the challenges for MDS in particular decade ago was that you wanted to prove that this was a stem cell problem, right? It's a clonal problem and arises from some damaged progenitor, and then they make blood that's from that malignant population, that cancerous population. And it was very hard to do that. You had to use a bunch of techniques to infer clonality. Only half of patients would have a cytogenetic abnormality. So most patients, you couldn't see something in the chromosome analysis that you do. And then you'd be inferring clonality either from increasing blast counts or looking at ring sideroblasts or trying to divine whether this arose from a cancerous population or not. And over the last decade in clinical practice, we have really incorporated the use of molecular diagnostics. A, we can characterize some recurrent mutation in almost every patient with MDS now. So nearly 100%, 90 plus percent of patients will have some abnormality that we can use to define the clonality of their disease and the composition of their disease. And we can use that to follow their treatment path. We're also understanding how this can tell us about the burden of disease. So when we think about going into a treatment like transplant, we're learning now, although we're still, this is behind where we are with therapeutics, but we're learning how changes in that molecular composition and the disease burden impact subsequent outcomes. And, you know, so I think when we meet a patient now, we have a much more complete picture of their disease, but we also have a more complete picture of where we want to go with them and maybe some intermediate goals that we're trying to explore to see how different therapies can impact both these short-term measures like the amount of disease or the presence of mutations, and also long-term, you know, monitoring disease after transplant is a whole new space in the era of molecular diagnostics, for instance.
Yeah, and just to build on what Andy's mentioning here, I really think that, you know, we're always striving, you know, I think the ultimate in clinical medicine would really be to try to individualize the approach for each patient. And that's just an evolving process. And as we know more about disease, we then have to try to figure out how that plays out and how treatments can be modified. I think that the trials that I just mentioned really solidified the clinical utility of transplant in more generally high-risk patients. But as Andy's mentioning, as we now have all this kind of molecular mutational data, you know, that wasn't incorporated in these studies that are just been published, you know, because it takes time for these trials to happen. And I think there's questions about, you know, are there certain subsets of patients that you may feel you need to go to transplant a little bit earlier in, even if they don't meet the you know, traditional high risk manifestation? So, you know, there'll be more to come there. Obviously, it's going to require years of investigation for us to have more firm data to support those decisions, but I think that that's one of the key places that the field of MDS and transplant have to kind of come together on moving forward.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, you know, the biggest challenge remains access. We have all these tools now, but if we aren't seeing patients, if they're never meeting somebody who does only transplant, or who has kind of been involved in some of this space, it's hard for them to even know all of the options, all of the changes that have happened over the last decade. I think access to transplant is multifaceted. It requires travel, it requires time on the behalf of the patients, requires family support. So it's not as if it's a straightforward fix. But I do think that understanding how important it is to think about transplant early in disease, and to use kind of an evolving repertoire of molecular markers as a way of predicting disease risk, both of these things really point to the importance of being seen soon, being seen early after diagnosis, having access to that kind of discussion, because it is something that is worth getting more people screened for.
No, that's a really interesting point you bring up. You know, you talk a lot about all of these advances that are really, really essentially making more people eligible for consideration for transplant in MDS. And would you say you've seen changes in utilization of transplant over the past decade or so? And have you seen any advances in things like insurance coverage as well for older patients who are potentially in need of a transplant?
Yes. I mean, there's a few, so far the conversation's really been on disease specific factors, right? But kind of taking a step back, and you can't necessarily address every issue in every single clinical trial, but there have been significant advances in the practice of allogeneic transplant that has allowed it to be applied more safely to a broader population of patients who may need potentially curative therapy. And if I were to kind of like summarize that in a few pieces, one is that we have a much wider availability of potential donor options, right? So traditionally, like even in the studies that we discussed before, they were limited to patients who were going to be receiving a transplant from a donor who was considered to be a full match from them. At this point, the use of half match transplants or partially matched unrelated donor transplants has really opened the pool of donors up tremendously. At this point, you keep that in mind, and the fact that there is also umbilical cord blood that can be used in certain circumstances as a transplant source. I mean, it is very rare at this point when we see a patient in clinic that we are unable to proceed to transplant because of lack of a donor, a suitable donor. So that is immensely important. I think the other piece that is very, very important is that there's been improvements in the components of the transplant, the chemotherapy or radiation that patients get before what we call the conditioning regimen can be given safely at lower doses, which is more tolerable, especially in older patients. There's better approaches to the prevention of graft-versus-host disease, which is one of the main immunologic complications after a transplant. So we're seeing less graft-versus-host disease and less severe graft-versus-host disease. And that has really also, therefore, you put all these factors together, it's allowed us to transplant patients who are older than what has been done in the past. We can, as was done in these studies, we can safely transplant patients in their 70s, which is something that a few decades ago was really out of consideration. It really was not done that often. And that's where there were sometimes limitations in terms of insurance coverage, because it was like, where's the proof or the evidence that this is a good idea? But you know, we've been able to demonstrate as a transplant community over decades, over at least the last decade, with multiple publications, some specific to MDS, some more general about the patients that we take to transplant, that when you carefully evaluate patients, that their age alone should not be the determining or limiting factor in their eligibility to receive potentially curative treatment, and that that good outcomes can be achieved for these patients when transplant is applied correctly.
Yeah, I think it's also humbling, I guess, to talk about the non-transplant path with patients, especially with high-risk disease. And I think this is reflected in the, some of the studies that we've been discussing recently. You know, it is hard for some patients, you know, when we sit down, especially if you're, maybe you're older, the investment of time and effort to go through treatment, which again, you know, our Zach and his colleagues, they support our patients incredibly well, but it is a little bit of a change in lifestyle for a bit to go through transplant, to be on immunosuppression, some differences logistically compared to receiving chemotherapy. I think the humbling thing from these studies, though, is that in spite of that, chemotherapy is no panacea, right? People, you know, even when we go through it, it doesn't save you from complications. And I think that that's one of the challenges that I have as someone who's interested in new therapeutics for MDS, is how to improve that. But the reality is right now, most of our therapies are not active in the majority of patients. You know, a few patients will get a complete remission with MDS with our current therapies. And they are palliative in nature. They don't last forever. Even people who do get a response, if you look at some longer-term data, you know, very few of them are alive by 5 years. So it's a real challenging disease for high-risk MDS. And to speak to some of the points you're making about, you know, utilization of therapy, absolutely. It's a, you know, MDS is a disease that happens in their in patients who are in their 70s on average. So they're older, and when age as a proxy for many things was cut off for the availability of transplant, you know, that limited a lot of the majority of patients who had MDS. But with that being less of a consideration, you know, I'm constantly talking about this, at least evaluating it, you know, to open up that discussion, because I think if you don't have the discussion at all, it's hard to know even if that's something that a patient would want to pursue. I think that the other factor is that, you know, if you look at treatment utilization across the U.S., for instance, as far as like claims-based data, or, you know, CIRM is a population-based database of a cancer registry, and it can be merged with Medicare claims files. If you look at patients over 65 in CIRM, that you know, what kind of treatments do they receive? The reality is, in MDS, we're still really under-treating most patients. If you think about it, patients with MDS, very few of them even get chemotherapy, let alone the number of transplanted patients in the U.S. is minuscule. And so, you know, even if we can shift that a little bit, offer potentially life-saving therapy to more patients, that will have a huge impact if we can shift how many people across the U.S. receive that. It's hard when your office is right next to the transplant team and you can walk back and forth and share every case that you have. You know, that's a very different, the patient's already there. So getting in the door is part of it.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the second half of this episode, where our guests discuss coordinated care and overcoming barriers to transplant for MDS.